This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 13th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 118th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week's show is full of cosmic energy, magic dust, New Year resolution in high definition. On this team, ladies and gentlemen, we are starting as we mean to go on. We hope you enjoy a show that will sound a little bit like this. We'll catch up with one of the world's real maverick thunderballs of energy and enthusiasm for creating chaos in a scientific setting. Nelly Ben-Hayoun is here to tell us all about her disaster a playground and adventures in space.
In this specific International Space Orchestra, they were reenacting all the drama of Mission Control, so everything that went wrong when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went up there in space.
We'll also get a top-quality, jaw-dropping live Midori House session from jazz legend Gregory Porter. Do not miss this man.
I never really feel a pressure to impress. I can only be me, and on any given night, I'm just going to come to you as I am. That's been my approach, and thus far has been successful.
And we'll investigate cinema from Ghana. No longer are open-air cinemas being turned into New Age churches. The filmmakers are staging a fight back.
Cinema could contribute economically to the Ghanaian economy. And we are losing out because we are not really churning out films. And even our own archives have been left for dead.
Plus, a visit to see the archiving of the entire internet, a lesson in Indian cinema, and what to make of the news that streaming is taking over digital music sales. We're covering all the hot topics this week here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Gregory Porter is a jazz genius, soulful singer and a brilliantly talented composer. Long hailed by the jazz world as their latest and greatest talent, he was nominated for one Grammy this time last year and is now in line for two of the awards, the results of which will be announced on the 26th of January. His first album, Be Good, scored high on charts in the US, UK and around the world, and he recently released his latest work, Liquid Spirit, on Blue Note Records. We were lucky enough to have him visit us last week to play some tracks. A packed house down in the session area, and for good reason. Here he is with the title track of that great new record, Liquid Spirit.
Henry, route the river, let that damn water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free. The folk are thirsty 'cause of man's unnatural hand. Watch what happens when the people catch wind of water hitting the banks of hard, dry land. Clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Get ready for the wave. It might strike like a final flood. The people haven't drank in so long, the water won't even make mud. After it comes, it might come with a steady flow. Grab the roots of the tree down by the river. Dip your cup when your spirit's low. Clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now, now. Na 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 na. Hey, 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 hey. Dip down, take a drink, and fill your water tank. Dip down, take a drink, and fill your water tank. Get ready for the wave. Might strike like the final flood. The people haven't drank in so long, the water won't even make mud. After it comes, it might come with a steady flow. Grab the roots of the tree down by the river. Dip your cup when your spirit's low. Clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now.
The That was Gregory Porter playing Liquid Spirit, and there's plenty more where that came from, so stay tuned. For now, though, we'll meet another star from a different realm. What realm? You might well ask. French designer Nelly Ben-Hayoun is a maker of note, not of things, but of experiences. Ben-Hayoun is the designer of experiences at the SETI Institute, that which searches for intelligent extraterrestrials. She's also head of experiences at file-sharing site WeTransfer, and she's the director of the International Space Orchestra at NASA. Plus, she's training to be an astronaut. It's no surprise she's earned the nickname the Willy Wonka of design and science. Nelly's latest project is a so-called disaster playground. A what? She dropped by to tell us what on earth's going on.
This is Apollo Control in Houston. The Apollo Command Module Columbia, flown by astronaut Mike Collins, is about to come around into view of Earth, followed soon after by the Lunar Module Eagle, with astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
It's a project which investigates the design of emergency procedure in the space program. I started to grow this idea that actually if you want to reconnect the public with the beauty of space exploration, then you kind of instead of just showing them the beauty and the incredible picture behind it, maybe you should show them the difficulty and the risk which are involved with it. And so you kind of get into the office of the guy who will answer the phone call once we figure out that there is this 200 kilometer diameter, asteroid popping up. And you kind of follow the track of this phone call all the way to the White House. But it's all done with the real guys, and it's really rare that you actually get a chance to engage with them.
How keen were NASA, for example, to be involved in this? Do they want to kind of sell their story slightly and sort of make what they do a little bit more accessible to people? Or did you just twist their arm, Nelly?
Well, a bit of both, right? It's they got the idea, and mainly astronauts actually really get it because, the training of astronauts is all about unexpected failure. So their whole training is about that. So when I come to them and I interview them about, what are the risks involved in each of the mission, they like to speak about it. But it's, of course, for some, it doesn't make sense. For other, for example, Charles Bolden, who is the head of NASA at the moment, is saying that failure is not an option. Which, yes, we understand, but then at the same time, I really believe, and it's something that has been used by the Greek really early on, in the catharsis, mm-hmm. where you will have the Greek chorus there. And so public will kind of sympathize for the Greek chorus with saying the nightmare of Antigone or things like that. And I kind of believe that this sort of dramatic situation is really will help kind of reconnect the public.
The SETI Institute is someone that you also work with. Tell us about the work that you do with those guys.
So the SETI Institute is a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, but life as well, of course. It's kind of going beyond what we, beyond the Earth and trying to figure out whether or not there is other things out there. And most of the scientists at NASA have also a job at the SETI Institute, but it's kind of more specific to bacteria and, Curiosity, which is the Mars rover, is collecting samples to try and figure out as well if there is any, bacteria or things that will show that there is life. So Carl Sagan and Frank Drake initiated the SETI Institute back in the 80s. And I work with them to actually design experiences for the public to engage with, with what they do. I think that, nowadays the fact is if you want to engage the public with a cause or anything like that, you need to give them a physical, emotional, response. So you need to go really towards the extreme and take a really extreme approach. And that's what I'm trying to do in my job, ranging from trying to make dark energy in your kitchen sink to lifting you up into your living room to, all these experiences or giving you the experience of a sonic boom. All these things are there to actually really impact on you to the point where you're oh, what the hell did I just experience? I want to know more. And then maybe eventually you will want to support the cause as well.
I was talking to my producer, Katie, earlier on, and we were making the point, we were wondering whether science is becoming more cultural, or whether the way of explaining it to people and the way of explaining what scientific institutes, for example, do, the people you work with, making stuff more fun, making stuff more accessible, and also making stuff more cultural. Do you see a trend towards that?
It's all about how you kind of make this connection between the two worlds, between the artistic world, the design world, and and then the scientist community. And I don't believe that this happened in a smooth way. I believe, and it's maybe because I'm French, I don't know, coming back to the culture element of it, that can only happen through conflict. Okay. So, you know, when I start to work with a scientist, I will never come to him and tell him that he's fantastic or that his research is amazing. Or because most of the time when designers go and approach or scientists or artists, you know, go and approach scientists, they always have this sort of, you know, I don't feel that I know enough of your topic. And there is this sort of like top down approach. And so I try to like disturb that. And, you know, and then, yes, he's got his expertise in his own field, but I've got my expertise in my field as well. And so, you know, and then, of course, I kind of like tackle it like that. And that's where, you know, some sort of like incredible outcome or ideas come
I suppose
from.
You're kind of fused. You're trying to fuse two elements that don't want to be fused almost some of the time, right? Or you're putting two volatile elements in a test tube and seeing if they explode. And that,
yeah, that's
there
exactly
is creation.
It.
That's the genesis of a lot of things, right?
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think it can only happen through conflict. And I'm not working for science as well. You know, it's like I'm working with scientists to actually define, you know, experience for us. So, you know, I don't do democratization of science as such, you know, like I'm more about like actually us having a more of a physical experience of things.
I wanted to ask you before we go about the International Space Orchestra, of which you are the director.
Yeah.
A performance has happened, but it's an ongoing thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So the International Space Orchestra is an orchestra made of, you know, space scientists from NASA Ames Research Center, the SETI Institute, Singularity University, you know, and the International Space University. So basically, the space community, which is in place in California. And so basically, I kind of like got them all together, and some of them were musicians, others weren't. So you've got, you know, the deputy director of NASA Ames Research Center who is playing the gong, astronaut Gagarin playing the percussion. And so all of them, you know, represent different departments at NASA Ames, and basically we commission people. So Damon Abel came on board, Bruce Serling, the science fiction author, came on board with his wife, Jasmina Tezanovich. You know, we had Mawa Denki, who is a Japanese composer, who actually all of them compose their music or write them lyrics, which are related to their mission, and usually taking kind of a tongue-in-cheek approach as well each time. So they performed in front of the world's largest wind tunnel, which was, you know, the place where you've got all the, you know, rocket being tried out.
Uh-huh.
And so in this specific International Space Orchestra, they were reenacting all the drama of Mission Control. So everything that went wrong when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went up there in space. You know, the International Space Orchestra now is like a counterculture within the agency. It's like it's a place where, you know, amateur, you know, and scientists who like music as well, come on board and discuss about what is going to be the future of exploration. It's like it's a place, yes, for music, but it's a place for critical thinking as well. There is massive news coming up for next year as well, and we will be performing as well as part of Disaster Playground. But I can't tell much about it, so you just need to keep up.
We'll keep up.
Looking at the website, because the news will be, you know, presented there.
Your head of experiences at WeTransfer. WeTransfer is something that we use on this radio station to send, you know, when we're out in the field, wherever we are, we upload the stuff and then they download it in the studio here. What, you're causing trouble there now as well?
Yes, totally. But it's a collaboration, right, between my studio and WeTransfer. And basically, I met with Nalden, who funded the, you know, WeTransfer with Bass Barons. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have content related to what they do. And I was really interested to actually discuss with the digital community and actually figure out how you can turn a digital community into something much more physical, which is what my job entails. And so it kind of like seemed totally rational that at some point our two worlds will collide. And that's what is happening with this fancy job title. It's basically, you know, I'm going to share this journey that I'm doing with like the project I'm already developing with the studio within WeTransfer, so through their background and the use of their background, and looking at as well how you can bring in, you know, film, you know, within this all. So while you upload the file, you can have like a sort of a physical experience with the film. But we can think about many other ways that this can develop. But the visual diary would be visible on WeTransfer. So whenever you whenever you upload a file, you will be able to know where I am and with who I am at that point in time. And you will be able to meet with these people.
She's got it covered. 903, brushing teeth. What happens if it's something that you're doing that isn't interesting for once? I guess you just don't put those things on it.
No, I put everything.
Okay.
You know, I think I'm not scared of failure. My whole job is about failure.
Okay.
It's like, I think this is a thing as well. It's like if within your auditor there is anyone who is a student or want to like go into the creative industry and so on, I would just recommend them to just go for the risky option and fail and never give up.
Nelly Ben-Hayoun there. And if you want to try and keep up with her ever-expanding CV, visit nellyben.com. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where it's time now to talk a business, a music business. Last week, Billboard reported that digital music sales in the US had declined for the first time since the launch of iTunes a decade ago, while streaming was up 24% in the first half of the year. At the same time, here in the UK, the news came that the number of people streaming music had almost doubled in 2013, and that Daft Punk's Get Lucky, which was the most streamed track of the year, was also the second best-selling single. So has the industry found a way to monetize streaming, or is this more bad news for artists and labels? And how does the way we listen to music change the relationship we have with it? I spoke to Luke Turner, associate editor at music website thequietest.com, to get his take on it.
Sometimes musicians kind of don't look at this in the long term. I mean, if the alternative is people not buying music at all, then things like services like Spotify bode very well for the future. And also, it's not necessarily Spotify's fault that people aren't getting lots of money from it. A lot of it is their record labels and management, the digital side of things, have got shoddy bits in their record contracts. So that's why they're not getting huge sums of money, and it's quite minuscule. And it's quite interesting that some, in Sweden, there's a court case where a group are taking their label, I believe, to court over this. And in
For not making enough royalties from streaming.
Spotify, yeah. And I know the Beggars Group have done a very good deal, which is they split, instead of sort of treating a stream like a sale where it's like a 20% maybe would go to the artist, the Beggars Group split everything 50-50. Mm-hmm. So that's a more positive step. I mean, it's interesting, you look at those figures. I think the interesting parallel, I noticed that, you know, streaming is now 10% of total music industry in Britain. CDs were down from 76.8 to 64%. Of sales, of sharing the market. And I think that's very telling. I think kind of people who would used to have bought CDs are now streaming.
If you were still investing £12 in a CD a year or two or three ago, these possibly are the sort of people that are subscribing to the premium version of these streaming sites, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the price point is a bit low on Spotify. I think £9.99 a month is...
It's amazingly good value.
And maybe some people, the £10 a month... one album month market, but I think they could pay a little more, or maybe do some kind of different service where if you want to hear an album the day of release, you have to pay a £20 a month sub. But I do think this, it's probably my looking at those figures, I think the streaming market is eating into the CD market. I buy music digitally and I buy a lot of vinyl, and obviously vinyl sales are biggest level since 1997, I think, at the moment.
And this is always that interesting sort of seesaw where the sort of latest and greatest way of listening to music, or the latest way of listening to music, is streaming, and then maybe the greatest is listening to it on a turntable. It's amazing that they sort of met in the middle.
Yeah, and I think so. I think people use Spotify as a try before you buy thing with vinyl. I love the fact with vinyl now you usually get a download code in there so you can get the MP3s pretty quickly. Amazes me when people don't do that. I think some of the things we'll be seeing as we move on is labels putting in higher quality MP3s with vinyl and things like that. And I think part of the rise of vinyl, I see it as a bit of a bigger trend. Maybe I'm being very optimistic here, that people are starting to realise that if they want creativity to continue, somebody's going to have to pay for it. And I think if you sort of accept that in your mind, which I imagine a lot of people who buy vinyl are, they're kind of people who are more into music and want to see it continuing and good art to be made. What better way of saying I'm putting my money where my mouth is and buying a nice artifact?
I wanted to drag you back to the statistic.
Yeah.
So we kicked off our conversation with this streaming doubling in 2013 number. I wondered if we could talk about how that changes people's listening habits. People said this when downloads, legal or paid for, kind of hit. People were buying a lot of singles again. You know, you don't have to buy the record. Neither do you have to buy Now 86. So you can take music one track at a time. Do you think that's the way people stream music? I wonder how you listen to it.
I am quite old-fashioned, so I do like albums. I've got a paid subscription, so I sort of make albums available for offline listening. I mean, if you look on Spotify, they've got that little bar that tells you how many tracks have been listened to, and it is often quite depressing that the ones at the front of the album are a lot, and then it just goes down and down and down, and maybe a single. And I know, but I've talked to artists about that, and they say, yeah, we know that that's the case, but we don't care. We're going to make albums as we want to make albums, thinking of it in two sides, even if people do that on Spotify. Yeah. I think artists are being pleasingly bloody-minded about this. But, you know, the single-track playlisting is amazing. For us as a publication on The Quietus, we every year when we do our albums of the year, my colleague John puts together a gigantic sort of one-day-long playlist of two tracks from every album that we've got there. And I know a lot of people, because it flicks up every time someone subscribes to it, so all day it's going bing, bing, bing. That's how people discover new music. I mean, we did our albums of the year this year in conjunction with Norman Records, a mail order vinyl and kind of some CD service. And I know people were reading our list of albums, listening to the playlist, then going and buying records because they had a great response. They got a lot of sales off the back of it. So I think, you know, there is a very positive connection between streaming and buying. We're going to have to look at this in a long-term way. I mean, the share of the market that Spotify has outside, I think, Sweden is tiny. I mean, how many paid subscribers they've got across the rest of the world? And if more and more people are signing up, which I think, given that how irritating the adverts on Spotify are and the ease of having it available offline, then there is this bigger pot of money. So that payments to artists is going to increase, particularly if artists make sure their deals with, where, as far as streaming go, are better written and better skewed in their favour. But I sort of do a straw poll every now and again, sort of small, particularly small labels and small artists, what do you think of Spotify? Pretty much all of them say, we really like it because people use it to find our music.
Yeah.
And it's great to get our music out there. And I think that's very interesting.
And that was Luke Turner from The Quietus. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, here on Monocle 24. Up next, everything you ever wanted to know about Ghana's cinema scene.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we cross now to Accra, because a group of young film directors funded by Ghanaians at home and those overseas are starting a cinema revival campaign. Movie going has been in decline in Ghana for some time. The industry has been poorly funded since the sale of the state's film assets more than 15 years ago. Distribution has moved to DVD, and many of Accra's traditional large open-air cinemas have become venues for the country's growing evangelical church movements. But now the young directors are fighting back by reclaiming the cinema space for its original purpose. Martin Davies sent us this report.
I am film, not steel. Oh, user, have mercy. If the pull on the take-up reel is too violent, I'm torn to shreds. I'm a delicate ribbon of film. Misuse me, and I disappoint thousands. Cherish me, and I delight and instruct the world.
These are the opening words of a movie which depicts how the Ghanaian film industry has been feeling misused and not cherished. The film's director is Anita Afonu.
We are losing. If you take Hollywood, Hollywood contributes to the GDP of the United States. And cinema could contribute economically to the Ghanaian economy. And we are losing out because we are not really churning out films. The government isn't interested in film, and even our own archives have been left for dead.
It's against this backdrop that a cinema revival is beginning.
Hi, my name is Akosi Adama Owusu, and I launched the Save the Rex initiative to revive one of Ghana's oldest cinema houses, the Rex Cinema, into an alternative creative space for art, music, and film.
At its launch, she explains her reasons.
Well, you know, I really felt that there was a lacking of a cinema-going culture in Ghana, and I noticed that a lot of my peers didn't have places to exhibit their work or perform, rehearse, and I just really felt that there was this need to create alternative cultural spaces, and you know, the Rex was left abandoned, and I was able to find a way to revive it through a Kickstarter campaign in hopes that I could possibly sustain it for future Ghanaian creatives.
Ghana's film industry is over a century old. Begun under British colonial rule, there was great optimism when it became the first independent sub-Saharan country, and its first president, Kwame Nkrumah, backed the industry. But Nkrumah's presidency was short-lived, ended abruptly by a coup. 40 years later, the nationalised industry suffered again. It was sold off to a Malaysian buyer. Critics say it was run into the ground, and archive film, a source of cultural identity, left to deteriorate and even burned. Film viewing in West Africa has also seen a trend towards DVD and home viewing. Nigerian movies have flooded the market. As cinema goers have stayed away, others have moved in.
In the mighty name of Jesus, Jehovah God is touching you. Jehovah God is touching you. Jehovah God is healing you. Jehovah God is doing something new now. Jesus is bringing your healing to pass.
A preacher talks to his evangelical flock inside one of the city's other open-air cinemas. This evening's service attracted hundreds, and film director Anita Afono, a practicing Christian herself, is uneasy about the consequences of religious feeling.
We as a country and as a people are so, so religious. We cry on God for everything. We're always blaming something on a spiritual something. And that needs to stop. We need to understand the reality of issues and deal with the problem. Ghanaians do not take responsibility for their actions. And that is what I show in my film. Our government, well, sold the film industry. What Nkrumah put up, all those that were interviewed in the film did not take responsibility in any way for that. And those were high-ranking people in cinema at the time.
Meanwhile, the woman behind the cinema revival says while she wants to see her project expand, she believes it can do so alongside the work of the churches.
I think I want to start small, you know. I think I want to do maybe something, you know, 2 times a month and then eventually work my way into every week and then possibly every day, except Sundays, where the church can come and stay and still praise and worship.
Back at the movie house, where the launch of the Saving Cinemas is underway, film enthusiast Winfred Addo, in his early 20s, believes the Rex's revival can spread.
For the Rex Cinema to come back, I think that just means that a lot more places might begin to spring up. And I might take a wild guess and say that I'm predicting to the future that many more people might start to build alternative movie places. Yes, once they see how successful the Rex is going to be, because I have no doubt in my mind it's going to be one of like the best places in town. Yeah, I like to come here every Saturday, watch a movie and just go home.
As it's the beginning or premiere of the campaign, the founders couldn't resist a touch of Hollywood in Accra.
And I've got to say, finally, I've never interviewed a film director on a red carpet before. It's great to be standing on the red carpet in Accra.
I know, right? I mean, I felt like it was just the perfect time. And why not? If we're going to open up a cinema house, we've got to have a red carpet.
For Monocle, in Accra, I'm Martin Davis.
Thanks, Martin. And some of the music you heard there was from the soundtrack of Perish Diamonds, a documentary film about Ghana's cinematic history, which came out last year. Still to come in part two, Grammy-nominated Gregory Porter will be talking us through the making of his new record. We'll meet the people trying to archive yesterday's web pages for tomorrow's world and get a potted history of Indian cinema. Much more to look forward to then on this here Culture Show with me, Robert Bounds. Now for another track from that quite spellbinding live session from Gregory Porter, and afterwards a chat with the big man himself, where we talked writing, musical upbringing, and about his transition onto that legendary label, Blue Note Records. First, here's Gregory live for us again from that album Liquid Spirit. This is No Love Dying.
There will be no love that's dying here. The bird that flew in through my window simply lost his way. He broke his wing, I helped him heal, and then he flew away. Well, the death of love is everywhere, but I won't let it be. There will be no love that's dying here for me. There will be no love dying here. The mirror that fell from the wall was raggedy, that's all. It rests up on a rusty nail before it made us fall. Well, the bones of love are everywhere, but I won't let it be. There will be no love that's dying here for me. Oh, there will be no love that's dying here. Four flowers in my Asian vase is not a sign we're dead. I paid for three, a sweet old lady gave me four instead. There's some doubt that's out about this love, but I won't let it be. There will be no love dying here for me. Oh.
Gregory, thank you so much for coming in and doing a Midori House session for us. A nice way to kick off the year. We had to fight the crowds away. It was like we were. We should have been selling tickets on the door for this one.
I think so, yeah.
It was a sort of hotly contested front seat, I think, to hear that session. I wondered what it's like touring the new record.
Yeah.
How much do gigs change from small venues to larger ones to radio sessions that you do? Because there are a couple of tracks that you took apart and put back together for us today, right?
Yeah. It's been cool traveling with this record. It's been cool having the two pretty successful records before me.
That's always cool, isn't it?
Yeah, because
it's nice to say that.
Right. You walk into to a place and they're like, you know, you already got two guns and then you got a third shooter. And so it's like people want to hear something from the old records and the new ones. And so there's no pressure to, and I never really feel a pressure to impress. I just, I can only be me. And on any given night, I'm just going to come to you as I am. And that's been my approach, and thus far it's been successful. I'm trying to come with it with a kind of organic spirit and just be me. Yeah.
Is that how the recording of the records has worked as well? You rock up, you've obviously got some, I don't know how prepared you come, whether they're sketches of songs, whether they're complete things, and then you riff. I wonder how you record them.
Yeah, well, the musicians that I work with, Chip Crawford on piano, Aaron James on bass, Emmanuel Harold on drums, Yosuke Sato on saxophone, that's my traveling band, and generally with recording, I also have Tavon Pennicott. I have a firm idea of what it is that I want to hear and what I want to be played, but I also want them to have their own musical charisma shine through in the music. And so I may have an idea, and they take it somewhere else. And that's cool, too, you know, because it'll take me somewhere else. And so I think that's the idea of the music, to push each other to different places. And my musicians surely do that.
Tell us about the lyrical content of the record. Some beautiful lines in there. I read in an interview that you talked about God, love, protest songs.
Yeah.
Some of these things are explicit. Some of them are implicit. You said to us, I think, between songs, you know.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about love, but it could be money. Who knows?
Right. And then when I say money, am I talking about money? No. It's like, you know, currency. Yeah. I mean, even with liquid spirit, I mean liquid in the monetary sense, in that spirit, love, energy, and culture to be quickly accessible. Unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free. It's like, let this ready spirit, this ready love, this ready energy, this ready culture, let that free. And when I say unreroute, because many of the things that we love are diverted to its proper demographic.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I'm just saying. Let the music free. And I mean in all aspects. I mean jazz, soul music, me, classical music, all of it will be palatable and loved by many people if we don't stigmatize it in a way. That's what I'm saying with the music.
Three shooters now you've got.
Yeah.
So, and the new one is on your new record is on Blue Note Records.
Yeah.
Your first for them. Yeah. Obviously a roster of legendary artists through the ages, run by a big personality, Don Was.
Yeah.
Does that make you sort of tuck your shirt in slightly, having to make a record for Blue Note?
No,
is it a different vibe?
Actually, Don said, you know, untuck your shirt. You know, okay. he was like, you know, just keep being you, keep doing what you do, be organic, and record the record, and then give it to us. And they didn't even have suggestions. They didn't say swing. They didn't say, you know, be soulful. They didn't say be funky. They just said, do you. And we're going to put the Blue Note label on it and try to get it out there. And that's a pretty big endorsement and confidence builder because, you know, Blue Note Records is jazz artists. That's where you want to be. And they didn't say be anything. They just said be you. And so I used to collect Blue Note Records, not based on anything other than it being a Blue Note record because...
That was a seal of quality, right?
Well, a seal of quality. And you knew the photography was going to be cool. Yeah. The liner notes were going to be cool. And it was going to be some interesting music. Not least of, you know, most of, but you knew, okay, if it was a Blue Note record, you know it's going to be cool. Whether at the record shop or the thrift store, it grabbed a Blue Note record.
That was the mighty double Grammy-nominated Gregory Porter. What a man. And his new album, Liquid Spirit, is out now on Blue Note Records. He's touring all over the world over the coming weeks and months. GregoryPorter.com is where to find all that information. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. In the west of San Francisco, there's a building that, thanks to its columns, looks like a small Greek temple. It used to be a former Christian Science church, but today it's a shrine to something a lot more modern. This is the home of the Internet Archive, which has set itself the mission of storing a copy of as much of the World Wide Web as it possibly can. Well, we were keen to find out more about this seemingly never-ending project, so we sent our correspondent, Alistair G, to find out about its ambitious plans.
If you wanted to go back to 1998, for example.
It's a rainy day in San Francisco, and in a converted church, Alexis Rossi is going back in time. Or more precisely, she's searching through old web pages that were published on the internet 15 years ago and have long since disappeared.
And there you go. Oh my gosh. Wow, that's some old design.
Rossi is an employee at the Internet Archive, an organization with an idiosyncratic mission. It believes that even something as young as the internet needs a historical repository. That's why it's been storing copies of web pages since 1996, which was the Stone Age as far as the internet is concerned. This means that on the servers dotted throughout the building, and emitting a sound a little like airplane engines, there is a copy of a sizable chunk of the entire World Wide Web. You might think of the Internet Archive as the physical home of the internet, and it has plans that are nothing if not ambitious.
I'm a digital librarian.
That's Brewster Kahle, who founded the non-profit Internet Archive, and indeed, above the door to his office, off the large open-plan space where the staff work, there is a large sign reading, Librarian. Kahle has been in the public eye recently owing to a fire at the archive that destroyed some equipment, though the damage was limited. He studied artificial intelligence at MIT and was involved in creating early web technologies before starting the archive.
We're trying to build the Library of Alexandria version 2, but hopefully we can one-up the Greeks by making it accessible to everybody anywhere in the world.
The Wayback Machine, as the collection of old web pages is known, attracts 600,000 users per day who are digging through things like past iterations of the Google site and homepages on GeoCities, which was one of the first free web hosting services but has now been shut down. However, the Wayback Machine is only one part of the Internet Archive, as Kahle explains during a tour of his headquarters.
We're digitizing VHS tapes and Betamax tapes and learning how to store software that were originally on floppies. We have book scanners here.
As Kahle makes clear, the Internet Archive wants to store, well, everything. Copies of books, music, news programs, you name it. Over at a workstation half enclosed by a black tent to keep out the light, Karina Martinez is scanning old books.
Right now I'm working on a magazine called Presto Press. The date is from June 26, 1968.
Her colleague Lan Zhu is doing the same thing nearby. Jessie Bell, the scanning coordinator, looks on and explains how it works.
What Lan does is she takes a book, she puts it in our cradle. So what happens is two panes of glass come down on the book and it flattens both the left and the right page. So it's sitting in an open position. And what Lan will do is she will click our shoot button and that will enable both our left and right cameras to take an image of each page.
Around two-thirds of the Internet Archive's 150 staff are actually scanners, based at 30 scanning centres in 8 countries, including in the Library of Congress. Bell says that each member of his team is able to scan up to 8,000 pages a day, and so far, the Internet Archive has made several million books available online. Most visitors to the Internet Archive website probably don't have a sense of one of the more unusual aspects of the project, the former church in which it's based. As office manager Chris Butler explains, the organisation has left some parts of the church almost exactly as they were, including the main devotional space, which has stained glass, pews, and something a bit, well, weird.
Also, we've got statues all throughout this room, and these are archive staff members.
Yes, you heard correctly. Where once Christian Scientists came to pray, there are now dozens of figurines standing in front of the pews.
They're about 3 feet tall, so if you ever come up here at night, you see kind of a silhouette of rows and rows of very small people, and so if you were to come up here, you know, for the first time at night, it could perhaps look a little on the creepy side.
Back in the office, staff members explain how the archive is progressing with one of its newest projects, putting archives of TV news shows online.
The two prime ministers agreed that advanced medical technology and systems from Japan will be used to improve medicine in Cambodia.
They've already made around 500,000 news programs available. It's no surprise that with all these endeavours, the Wayback Machine, the books, the audiovisual files, they've accumulated a hefty amount of information. It adds up to around 15 petabytes of data, or almost 16 million gigabytes, stored in the San Francisco headquarters. Alexa Rossi, who runs the Wayback Machine, says she thinks that their work has a prophylactic aspect.
A lot of the things that we have in the Wayback Machine, particularly when you're looking at things from, you know, the mid-90s or late 90s, are things that people thought were not important at the time. They're things that I think people at the time thought were throwaway pieces of information that would disappear. And the idea that we still have them, you know, 15 years later or however long, is really satisfying to me, because you never know what's going to be important. You don't know until it's gone.
This does, of course, sound sensible. Just remember, be careful what you write on your blog, because it might be around for longer than you think. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
Thanks, Alistair, and you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounce, on Monocle 24. We're going to meet the godmother of Indian cinema next.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture. Indian cinema is primarily associated with spectacular Bollywood movies, stuffed with music and dance routines, but there's a lot more going on in the studios of the world's second most populous country than that. Aruna Vasude is the head of NETPAC, an organisation that promotes Asian cinema and is seen as somewhat of a godmother to the Indian film industry. Venetia Rainey caught up with her recently at the Tripoli International Film Festival in Lebanon to pick her brain on Bollywood versus art cinema and her favourite Indian movie on the program, Ship of Theseus.
Aruna Vasude, I am the founder, director, and president still of NETPAC, which is the International Network for the Promotion of Asian Cinema. And it was started in 1990, so it's been going quite a long time. The aim of NETPAC was for Asian audiences to see Asian films, for us to get to know each other better and use the cinema as a tool, because I believe cinema is the most potent culture carrier there is. The audiences started picking it up very fast. I was quite surprised when we started it in India. The hall for the film used to be about half full. By the second year, it was three quarters full. By the third year, they actually broke down the door of the cinema because they wanted to go and see a film by Wong Kar-wai. When I started this, and people really didn't know, never heard of Thailand or Indonesia. Maybe they'd heard about Japan and China, but that was about it. Even Southeast Asia, absolutely unknown territory. And Arab countries, West Asia, not at all. So it was a very exciting thing to do, is to make people, give them an opportunity to discover these cinemas, and they really got interested. And these were all young people. Now an older audience is still hung up on Bollywood and the big entertainment films. I think Bollywood has a place in the scheme of things. It certainly made India known. But if you're talking of art cinema, if you're talking of cinema as an art, then there is another kind of cinema. And it is that kind of cinema that gives you insights into other cultures, into other ways of living, which are similar yet different. Now, when they tried with on television in India to show American serials, Indian audiences said, why are they behaving like this? What's wrong with them? Are they ill? Is there something wrong with them? They didn't like it at all. But when you do show films from Asia, they feel very comfortable and intrigued that, oh, it's so much like us and yet so different. Oh, there's such a transformation going on in society that you really, everything you say is true and everything you say is false about India. But really, you cannot make any generalizations anymore. Ship of Theseus, I know, I've seen, I like very much. I think it's an extraordinarily interesting and well done film. I really like it.
You mentioned on your site that you actually took up photography after you lost your eyesight to
an cornea infection.
Yes.
Yeah, true.
And the name, people wonder about the name. The film is about, in a way, organ donation. And so he talks about the Ship of Theseus, which when it sank and they pulled it out the ocean and then they changed parts of it. In the end, they changed all parts of it. So then, was it still the Ship of Theseus or was it something else? So if you get someone else's organ in your body, is it still your body or is it someone else's? It's just an interesting proposition to explore, and which he does very well in this film.
What about the violence you are committing on yourself by not taking medication? And how is your choice not different from that of a suicide bomber who's so convinced about the fundamentalism of his political and religious thoughts?
Are you really making that analogy?
It's got huge international attention. I think it was the Union of British Film Critics that voted it as one of the 15 most life-changing films. It's quite remarkable. A film made by a young man, his first film, and he comes up with something so original and so well handled. That is what's so impressive. But sometimes young people come up with great ideas, they don't know how to put it together, but he did, he does, he done it, he's done it.
That was Aruna Vizude, head of NetPAC, speaking to Venetia Rainey. And that colourful little piece brings us to the end of the show for this week. Next time, we'll be wondering what makes the London Art Fair tick in such a crowded art marketplace, and we'll be previewing the Sundance Film Festival. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher added her usual audio garnish to turn this programme into a Michelin-starred offering. Time for one final song this week from his wonderful Midori House session and his latest album, Liquid Spirit. This is the phenomenal Gregory Porter with Water Under Bridges. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Somebody told me get over it. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. They say it gets better, it gets easier. The memories start to fade, and sad songs that always play you start to hate. Do you remember the days we used to spend? Memory so strong it keeps me from moving on. If I could go back, I'd take our worst days. Even our worst days are better than loneliness. Somebody told me get over it. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. Spend memory so strong it keeps me from moving on. If I could go back, I'd take our worst days. Even our worst days are better than loneliness. Somebody told me get over it. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. It's like water under bridges that have already burned. They say it's like water under bridges that have already burned.